Welcome everybody to All About Symbian. This is Insight number 110. It is Friday, the 19th of March, 2010. Ewan is still in America. I'm sure he'll be home soon. He's apparently partying. Anyway, to discuss Ewan's travel plans, with me I have Mr. Rafe Blandford.
Hello, everybody.
There we are. We'll be back to normal next week, but in the meantime, it's Rafe and I for a quiet, intimate fireside chat. or maybe it's a couple of gigs round a pint in the pub. Anyway, on with some news and some discussion topics. I'm sure Ray's got some insights here, which we're going to learn a lot from, as usual. Ovimap's Navigation Free is now come out with the N86, but not officially. It's not on their it's not on the main maps.nokia.com yet, and there's no mention of the N85, N79, and N96. Rafe, any idea why it's all coming out in such piecemeal fashion?
Yes, I think this is a case of Nokia has to do it piece by piece because you have to test each device individually. There are always some small differences. And when you're doing something like OmniMaps, which has the potential to be used by a lot of people, you really want to get it right first time. Additionally, with things like the N85, the N96 and the N79, these are actually the older S63rd edition feature pack 2 devices, and they actually effectively run a version 1 of that variant of S60, and the more recent ones like the 55, 52 or the 86 actually are running a slightly more recent version. I mean, to be technical, I think it's S63.2.2, although it's not a number that Nokia refers to officially. There are some changes in things like web runtime and some of the underlying technology like Symbian pips and the POSIX support, which I believe the map uses, and so that may well be a reason why we haven't seen it emerge on those devices yet. The N86 was obviously a bit of an exception. I suspect that's down to extra testing on a specific device, maybe to do with a hardware combination or something like that. So the summary of all of that is Nokia haven't made any official statements, but sort of reading the tea leaves, we can say it's unsure about whether the older S63.2 devices will get it. I suspect there's a good chance either via firmware upgrade or via SW update, as with the N86, but I'm pretty confident in saying I don't expect to see Ovimap's 3.3 or the free navigation version on the older devices, that's to say S63rd edition feature pack 1 and prior to that. So that's devices like the E71 and the N95, of course. It's disappointing to some people, but it really is a question of resources. How many developers Nokia has in Berlin working on maps? Do they work on getting old devices to work, or do they work on new devices? As we said last week, and we've said on the site numerous times, it really is a case of being more efficient to work on the new stuff from a commercial point of view. Will disappoint some people, and there's been plenty of feedback.
We discussed that last week, didn't we? With the reduced license fee. I mean, somebody came to me, a customer, the other day, and said, can you just guide me through paying this 60 quid for Ovimaps off of my E71? And I said, well, good news. It's only going to cost you £9 for a year. And he couldn't believe it. £9 for a year for the whole of Europe. So without wishing to go into last week's rant again, I think that's as much of a carrot as they're going to throw the older devices for now, I suspect.
Absolutely. So please stop emailing me about how outrageous it is and that you'd like me to fix it, because apart from not being within my power to do so, I actually think Nokia have gone beyond what they really need to do.
I thought everything was within your power, eh?
Well, you may fondly imagine that, Steve, but I think that's definitely not the case.
Posted yesterday on the site, a very interesting, very sci-fi like, you know, almost like holograms or something out of a movie. You posted this video created by yourself and Mr. Ewan McLeod of Navtech True, and I quote from your news item here: "The system, when placed on top of a vehicle, combines a LiDAR system, which I imagine is something to do with lasers, multiple panoramic cameras, and positioning GPS and IMU, whatever that is, sensors. So it all looked very, very sci-fi like. You can't help wonder how long it's going to take them to go around the entire world with this 1 million bits of data per second scanning to try and get this sort of resolution into their system. Is this pie in the sky, Rafe? Do you think it will be here anytime soon?
No, I think this is absolutely real. I mean, Nokia, Navtech are rolling out this to their whole fleet of vehicles, but clearly it is going to take some time to do the data processing. And I think the important thing to realise here is they're collecting a raw data set, and they will then be processing that to produce various add-ons to their existing products, which will evolve over time. And what they're doing here is sort of moving on from the sort of 2D maps, which have really generally been done by just driving along roads and taking panoramic photos to the next generation of data collection technology, which will let them do the 3D maps. And just taking, I mean, the photograph and the GPS stuff is fairly self-evident. The IMU is actually an inertial sensor, basically measuring, presumably with things like accelerometers and gyroscopes, how fast the car's moving, the sort of tilt on it for things like slope attributes in the car. But the LiDAR basically sends out a laser and waits for the pulse to bounce back, and it does that obviously millions of times a second, and it's rotating throughout 360 degrees and there's 64 lasers. But what it does is it enables them to build up a 3D model of the area around them, which is quite literally a 3D model made up of discrete points, which has information about their time they take to come back, which obviously calculates the distance, and the reflectivity, which tells you about the substance that's being bounced off. So in the case of road signs, it can read a road sign. That's then combined with the photographic data. And what this is really about is sort of building the next generation of maps, but it also makes it much easier to collect attribute data. So for example, this system can measure the width of a lane on a road to the nearest centimetre. Now, what people need to realise is this isn't in one sense about visualisation. Clearly, that's one end product. But most of all, it's about being able to automatically collect some of the 200-plus attributes that Navtech will have in their sort of digital mapping database about a road. And that's everything from, you know, the speed limit, you know, simple things to much more complicated things like how wide is the lane, what is the angle of it, and some of which will never be used in the mapping product, typically for sat-nav, but will be used in other sort of business-related things, perhaps industrial tracking and things like that. So Navtech is very much building a very complex map. Isn't really the right word. It's an entire geo-referenced geospatial database. So yes, I think this is very much not pie in the sky. At the same time, you're right, it will take some time to collect. But what this really does for the end consumer, the way they need to think about it is that so the current generation is really about driving along these roads so they can collect information about where the roads are in terms of the GPS tracks, and maybe a little bit about, you know, their height and their angle, limited information about lanes as well. And they will also take photographs to give you the Google Street View type of things, or to build the 3D landmarks you see in Navtech. But this technology really is next generation. And I wanted to put this video up on the side. It's not really directly related to any particular mobile platform. Indeed, you'll see this on all mobile platforms. But I think it does give a really good flavour of what's to come. And the idea that, you know, digital mapping really is right in its infancy in terms of what can be done. But yes, this could absolutely be used to build up, you know, a 3D visualisation. So when you're driving along, you can actually sort of drive through it for real in both a 3D map, and then they can combine in the photos. But as I say, that's really only sort of the most obvious application of the visualization. You can think of all this sort of information could be potentially processed to do much more. I mean, one of the things they spoke about was, in theory at least, you could use this to pull off the information from a menu outside a restaurant. Now, obviously, that goes above and beyond. But when you've got that amount of data, you can start doing some very interesting things with it.
Yeah. Moving on, Microsoft have released Silverlight for Symbian. I'm not sure this is a good thing or a bad thing. I guess it's good. A beta of Silverlight for Symbian is available at their Mix 10 conference. It's been announced. I believe you can download and play with it. There's not that much, I guess, you can actually run on it to demonstrate how it works. Is it fully third edition compatible, Rafe?
At the moment, it's only for a 65th edition, and it probably will remain that way. It's worth pointing out this is very much a beta release. It's available through Nokia's Beta Labs as well as on the Microsoft website, and it's really a developer preview rather than something for consumers. Although, if you want to try it out, there is a sort of Bing application available, which sort of gives you a extra powerful search tool. But really, it is only of interest to developers. And what Silverlight is, it's really Microsoft's cross-platform multimedia stroke web application creation tool. I think you can think of this as it uses a lot of Microsoft technologies. It's basically a .NET runtime mixed in with some of Microsoft's other technologies. And it will allow you to do cross-platform stuff using Microsoft technologies. Now, you may view that as a good or bad thing. Really, I think it's just about adding more runtime choice to Symbian. From that point of view, it's good. It's the same technology that Microsoft is using in Windows Phone 7's developer platform and application framework, of which a little bit more later, perhaps. But as I say, it's really about expanding developer choice. I suspect in this case it will really be used to port applications that are already running on Silverlight to add the functionality of them to the Symbian platform, rather than having to sort of port them into something else from scratch.
Presumably this is really looking to the future, because get the current generation of Symbian devices, a 65th edition, certainly from Nokia, all have ridiculously low amounts of free RAM, and then you say, I'm going to add in something that's based on .NET called Silverlight by Microsoft, and that doesn't inspire confidence in terms of RAM efficiency.
Well, that's probably a fair point. I mean, I did have a quick look at it, and yes, the beta was a little bit memory hungry. Having said that, you know, Red 5 Labs, who were sadly now out of business, were able to produce something that worked pretty well in terms of .NET on Symbian, and it is more memory efficient, and it is sort of Silverlight 2 rather than the most recent version, and so it's perhaps the requirements are slightly less full. But yes, it's probably fair to say this is looking towards the future, where there will be more memory and more processors available on the phone, and so as with all these technologies, you know, they come out, and at the moment the performance is very sluggish. But I suspect by the time this, you know, gets to sort of commercial release, as I say, it will be really as a way of getting Silverlight running on Symbian, which is a good thing, rather than having to start something from scratch from Symbian. I don't really necessarily see it as many Symbian developers saying, oh, I'm going to use Silverlight to develop on Symbian because it's easier. It's really a case of Silverlight developers saying, well, I wouldn't have supported Symbian otherwise, but since they have the runtime on it, I'll make the extra effort to optimize it to run on Symbian as well.
Yeah, and presumably with enough RAM. I mean, things like the Samsung i9-10HD, I mean, it'll run quite happily because there'll be oodles of RAM to play with.
Absolutely, and it's really just like the flash technology. If you remember when that first came onto the handsets, it was really only the basic stuff it could do. And since then, that's evolved over the years. So, you know, Flashlight 1 and up to Flashlight 3 now, and going on in the future, sort of Adobe Air and sort of Flash 10 will be unified for both desktop and mobile.
And it's all still rather sluggish.
Yes, but I mean, you can now actually play back the YouTube videos natively in the browser, which was something you never used to be able to do. And yes, it still may be a little on the sluggish side, but it's not too bad, and that is partly down to programming decisions. So you can get Flash applications that are very slick and very quick. So again, you know, it's about optimizing for the platform. But I was really making the comparison to the early days of Flash, where it was beyond a very, very simple application. It wasn't terribly useful to the point now at which it's being used for quite a lot for doing UIs, and is quite capable of producing very nice looking content on the phone. The fact that some people may choose to overburden it is perhaps a designer or a developer choice rather than the fault of the platform itself.
Yeah, that kind of comes back to the VVAS home screen, which I've been testing, as people, readers of the site, will know. And the whole home screen UI, written by Sonny Erickson for the VVAS, has been implemented in Flash. Now, is that Flash Lite or is that full Flash? I presume it's Lite again,
that's
right?
That's Flash Lite in that particular case. But that's a great example. It's got the Aquarium background, or the Flow background, which is very responsive in terms of, you know, responding to you tilting it with the accelerometer. And that's a great example of how the performance of Flash on mobile is actually pretty good now. And that's, you know, it's obviously been optimized for the handset rather than trying to run, you know, Flash content that's been written for the desktop on the device, which clearly is another story altogether.
Yeah, the Aquarium runs quite nicely, and obviously the accelerometer Flow, but I have to say the Twitter client that they've implemented, whoever thought that writing a Twitter client in Flash Lite was a good idea should be taken out and shot, because it runs, it's very sluggish, very stilted, and the functionality is very, very limited. So with something like a Twitter client, if you're going to put it in, do a proper job and have a proper functioning client with all the functions you want.
Absolutely, especially as Flashlight in its current form isn't really optimized for that kind of thing. I mean, that's where something like web runtime would maybe be a better performer, or indeed native application. I think that will partly be fixed with Flash 10, which is sort of the next version of Flash that we'll see on the mobile phones, where it is more of a rich internet application platform, as is sort of Silverlight and arguably things like JavaFX as well. It's interesting, you can tie this in with Nokia's Qt as well, although that sits slightly lower on the software platform, but they're all trying to do the same thing in terms of write once, cross-platform. and run anywhere. Of course, the reality is always a little different, and as we've already suggested here, you do have to tend to optimize for each platform.
Yeah, and they all of those things you just mentioned all need more free RAM. So I know Nokia are now on the case. Samsung, of course, were on the case. And just to move on to our next news item, slinkily, the i9 10HD, which we just mentioned, has been received a big update, but not from Samsung. Andy, aka HyperX, and we don't normally talk about modding and hacking, I suppose, is a too strong a word here, but modding phones are all about Symbian for obvious reasons. But in this case, the official firmware from Samsung, it is left you with under 20 megabytes of free space on disk C, which is just an untenable position, basically making the device unusable for anything serious. So in this case, we've been promoting it on the site, and we put a news item up. ROM 3.16 was the one we reported on. It's now up to 3.17, and the benefits of going down this route: you will lose your warranty, but you do get faster operation, more free space on disk C, up to 80 megabytes in extreme cases, which is a huge change from 18 megabytes. You get full frame rate 720p video recording with better quality audio capture. Say they apparently use it the same DLL as the VVAS. They've nicked it from the VVAS ROM somehow. Very clever, these modders. You now get full pre-autofocus in video capture, which is what we saw in the original prototype, Rafe, when we went to Staines about a year ago. You get full kinetic scrolling, N97 style, across the whole interface, better theme transitions, and the change log goes on and on and on. All of this is available now by going down the modding route. So I haven't tried it yet. I'm going to do a series for All About Symbian, taking my newbie status as somebody who's never modified or hacked a phone in his life, trying to steer the a positive and fairly legal, fairly sensible route through the through taking a virgin i9 10HD through to a fully modded 3.17 ROM with all these benefits, and to report at each stage on how I got on and what the pitfalls were and how I got over them. So hopefully that's coming up in the next week or so on All About Symbian. There's also Stuart Clark, who is a long-time associate of the site. He's also running this now, so I shall have some expert help from him, I'm sure, as well.
And but, the interesting thing here, of course, is that while Steve's doing all of this, I will be losing my hair worrying about the legal implications. As Steve suggested, that you'll certainly be breaking your warranty, and strictly speaking, this kind of hacking or modding is not legal, especially as Steve suggested, there are some inclusions of files from other firmwares altogether. Technically, I'm not sure Samsung would be terribly happy that you would be sort of dismantling the firmware. Having said that, this is quite common, as people will be aware, on things like Windows Mobile and Android as well, in terms of sort of home-baked or custom-baked ROMs. I just would add that there is a legal dimension to this, which is why we do have to be quite careful as a site. And this is a sort of a trial run, if you like. We will be keeping a very close eye on things, and the usual legal disclaimers do absolutely apply here. This is a personal decision and something we can't officially endorse. Yeah. But we'd be interested to have your feedback on what you think of this, and what position you think we should take on this, because I think with Symbian being available open source, this sort of thing is likely to become more common, not less common. Even with products that are perhaps quite well supported, people may well want to put their own custom ROMs on them. Symbian will be releasing code every 6 months in terms of updating OS, but there will also be possibly things that can be backported in terms of bug fixes that might be incorporated into custom firmware. So it's definitely an issue I think we'll be revisiting, and we'll just have to watch out for it, because when you publish this kind of thing, of course, it's a slightly different story to doing it yourself personally.
Yeah, so there will be disclaimers all over the article. Don't worry, Rafe. And you can point to me if the lawyers come a knocking. And it goes without saying that if anybody does follow my instructions and manages to brick their Samsung, there's absolutely nothing to do with All About Symbian, and we're not going to reimburse you. So it's entirely at your own risk. So we'll see how we get on. And if Samsung are listening, then want to head us off at the pass, then do please let us know that we're about to be in your bad books, and we'll think again. But I think it will be a fun project. It's just still the most highest specified Symbian device in the world. It has been for the last year or so. And it just seems great to see a group of people on the web actually making serious use of it and producing a seriously useful device.
So, and the manufacturers like Samsung and, you know, in due course, Nokia, Sony Ericsson, should really be encouraging this kind of activity, because it helps people get more out of their devices, creates a bigger emotional connection, all the kind of buzzwords that your marketing department want you to fall in love with. I mean, it really is building quite a powerful community around these phones. So within the legal frameworks, do everything you can to encourage it, I would say.
Yeah, yeah. It's also strictly a last resort. I mean, the reason we don't normally mention it is not just the legal ramifications. It's just that in most cases, if you hang on and be patient, the manufacturer will come up with a solution that's actually probably better than what you could achieve at home with limited resources. But this is an extreme case where the manufacturer is spread so thinly that they just haven't thought about what they've given the general public. And so somebody at home has been able to produce something that's more polished, more professional, and with better performance. So watch this space. A Wayfinder, which you may remember me championing back in 2004, 2005 on the Sony Ericsson P800, P900. It's basically an over-the-air navigation solution where everything, apps, maps and routes and POIs, they're all streamed over the air. It's a superb solution until you actually drive out in the country, then you've got no coverage and it all dies a horrible death and you get lost in the middle of nowhere and it's all Wayfinder's fault. Anyway, they did move on. They got bought out a few times. They've now died a cold Swedish death, as I reported in the headline. They were bought out by Vodafone, and Vodafone have now terminated the service. In the face of free navigation from the likes of Nokia and Google, I'm sure we'll roll out their free navigation at some point to the rest of the world. It was only a matter of time, really. And you can see the news stories in the press about TomTom and Garmin. And Wayfinder were very much a small fish in this big, big sea. And I'm afraid they just got eaten. Any comments, Rafe?
Yes, well, I just think it's rather sad. I mean, Wayfinder also bought Navicor themselves. So it's actually two products that you were sort of really seeing disappearing here. And I do think for their time, they were sort of industry leading in terms of the off-road thing. And sorry, I don't mean the off-road thing. I mean the off-device thing, in terms of being able to load up your device with all these maps, especially in the days where memory was rather more precious than it is today. Now we wouldn't think anything of downloading a couple of gigabytes of maps onto the phone. Back then, your memory card probably wasn't much more than 64 megabytes, in some cases at least anyway. The thing here, as you say, it's interesting from an industry point of view, because Vodafone have chosen not to continue investing in it, but have instead, given up the ghost. There was some speculation when the sort of free maps came out from Nokia that this might be a spur to operators to buy into some of these existing independent GPS units because they wanted to, provide their own offering in the free space, and it would sort of act as a spur to the entire industry. But I think it goes to prove that may have been a slightly vain hope. I think we'll still see that sort of thing from some of the bigger guys, particularly the likes of Copilot or TomTom doing deals with operators. But when you're something like an operator, you can do a deal with Nokia and get the free navigation and probably get a revenue share for things, some of the things that are going to come on top later on, and certainly will be benefiting from the data revenue. And there's obviously the ability to sell devices quite well using the free map offering. The other slightly sad thing about Wayfinder is there's something called Wayfinder Access, which was used by the partially sighted and blind people who wanted a GPS solution that worked for them. And obviously this is really an accessibility solution. I think there's a great deal of disappointment that Vodafone are also shattering this service, which really, for a lot of people, quite understandably gave freedom outside the home to be able to go and navigate around. So there's perhaps some hope that Vodafone may do the right thing and sort of step up and continue providing that service or pass it on to someone else who can do it. It's a subject we don't often talk about here on the podcast, but the Symbian phones in general are some of the more accessible ones thanks to some of the third-party software available, of which Wayfinder Access was one of them. The other big software in this area is, of course, something called Torx 5, which is developed by Nuance. And this is a screen reader for mobile phones or speak things onto the screen. As you know, there's some built-in software on the Nokia devices for this, but this takes it to a whole nother level, so that if you're partially sighted or legally blind, you're able to use the phone with obviously just audio prompts. And so just some related news here while we're on this sort of accessibility issue is that Nuance have announced that Torx 5 will be out for S60 5th edition phones. That currently only supports S60 3rd edition phones, will be out very shortly. And so for those of you who are, fall into that category, of whom I understand there are some listeners to this podcast, so thank you for the email that you've sent in. We'll try and address some of these issues more fully in the future, but it's a bit tricky if you obviously don't use the products yourself. But as I say, it's actually a surprisingly big user base out there, people using the products, particularly the Symbian devices, and again is a sort of endorsement of the openness of these phones in terms of being able to get down into the deeper layers, which you really need to do to create effective screen readers and things for accessibility issues. But as we say, Wayfinder there, I for one will sort of have a slight tear in my eyes that disappears off into the sunset. It's been left behind by industry moves, of course, so it's something of an inevitability about it, and I don't doubt that it will not be the last one we see disappear into the sunset.
Just on the subject of Ovimaps, which is pushing Wayfinder out, one of the programs to do so, there's a hot off the press news that of a new beta of 3.4 just been released on Nokia Beta Labs. So if you're listening to this on the Monday, go and grab that. It should be up ready for download and you'll have no problems with that, hopefully. Do give any feedback to the team there using their forums. I'm sure they'll help improve Ovimaps further. Our final item for discussion, Rafe wants to mention the W word, Windows. Windows Phone 7 series, a direct competitor of Symbian for a long time, of course. But Windows Phone 7 series, the big new update, which if I can briefly summarise, Rafe, and then you can give whatever you wanted to say. It's basically an all-singing, all-dancing, two-dimensional canvas with every part of your life is a sort of hub within this canvas. And then your phone window becomes a little... Your phone screen becomes a window onto this wider canvas as you scroll it around, as you move it up and down, left and right. It's a wonderful, wonderfully conceived interface, and it all makes perfect sense in the demos. But there are some huge, huge caveats. Microsoft have very much tried to ape the iPhone in some respects, it seems. There's no multitasking. So applications suspend and have to resume where they left off. There's no support for memory cards whatsoever. What you get in the phone is what you get. There is no backwards compatibility with any existing Windows Mobile applications. There's no copy and paste initially in the first release of the OS. So these are some pretty big downsides. So Rafe, what's your take on this?
I'm sort of it's always interesting talking about these kind of downsides, but I'm not really sure they're as big a deal as some people make out, because what Microsoft is doing here is effectively rebooting Windows Mobile into something that's aimed at sort of how the market has moved since they initially launched Windows Mobile. Underneath, it's still running on Windows CE, but effectively it's a whole new product range, for want of a better word. And I think some of the things that they've chosen to limit don't make an awful lot of sense. But then the tendency here is to look at it with a power user hat on. And this is really something they're going to be targeting at, I think, probably the 20-something generation, then the 30-something generation, who are maybe... used to the iPhone and things like that, where you don't, of course, have things like a memory card, and there are a lot of limitations on there. Some of them, I think, are down to the fact that they're racing to get this ready for the end of this year. So copy and paste has now widely been reported as being included shortly after launch. But I think that's really a perception issue more than anything else, because I'm not sure how many people really use copy and paste on their phone. But I think they probably could have maybe handled the PR around this a little bit better and saying, you know, we want to make sure the solution's absolutely right. And so it won't be available initially, but there'll be a software update quite soon. They've already talked about the software update story at least a little bit, saying that it will be happening and can expect to see these devices evolve over time. But I mean, I agree with you, the execution of the user interface is very interesting indeed. Microsoft also, in something of a departure from Windows Mobile, are being very specific about the hardware configuration, both in terms of things like memory and screen size, but right down to the number of buttons on the units themselves. And so this is very much, I think, changing Windows Mobile into a vertical play, which personally I feel is the right move for Microsoft. I think they can tie in with their services like Xbox, like Zune as well, and create quite a powerful solution. Also, it brings in Bing with its maps and its search, so it can create a product that will be quite consuming to the appealing to the consumer. Sorry, I should say. And what it is really here is walking into a shop, you will see a product, and you know, while a lot of people listening to this podcast will debate the technical merits, a lot of people will just go and see and buy what they think looks nice based on a few minutes of play. And that's where I think Windows Phone 7 series could do very well indeed. I mean, it's a little bit sort of pie in the sky at the moment, because, of course, we've seen a couple of the sort of demos, and I saw it running on some sort of prototype hardware, Mobile World Congress, but that's a long way from running on final hardware in sort of 9 months' time. and there can be any number of changes, and you know, the design of the phones will come in and all kind of things. So it makes it hard to make any firm conclusions. But I certainly think Microsoft are running in the right direction. In some ways, by doing this, I think they're becoming less of a competitor to Symbian, and they're competing more really with the iPhone and perhaps to a lesser extent BlackBerry in the consumer space. And so it is a change in direction, but I think it will cause Apple in general quite a large pause for thought, because while a lot of sort of technical geeks may get hot under the collar about the Microsoft versus Apple thing, I think what Apple do very well is create something, but Microsoft are also very good at taking this in a sort of I wouldn't call it copying, because I think they've done a lot of innovation themselves, but taking a similar kind of market concept and building it out with a variety of manufacturers in a very cost-effective way, in a sense that they may be able to undercut Apple. Now, there are some questions around the developer framework, which they announced at the Mixed conference in Las Vegas this week, and it's, as I mentioned earlier, Silverlight-based, also XNA for doing sort of high graphics for games. So there's a lot of capability within the platform, and I think it could prove very promising indeed. It really is just down to execution. But just to tie back into what Steve was saying, the sort of limitations, I think it's easy to see them as limitations when you think about them in the context of the current market. But if you're doing a sort of reboot, yes, you potentially alienate a lot of your existing customers, but without being too harsh to Windows Mobile, there aren't all that many out there at the moment. You know, we're thinking in the tens of millions versus the hundreds of millions for Symbian. And when we think about the potential market, they're not looking at, you know, a few million. They're looking at, you know, 10, 20, 30, 50 million, going up towards 100 million. You know, this is the change from smartphone as kind of niche devices to something that becomes your personal digital companion, if you will. And so, yes, there are some issues around the things Steve talked about, but I wouldn't get too hung up on them, because I think the market kind of moves beyond that. And Microsoft, you know, while of course they do want the high-end people, they want the geeks and the early adopters, they also need to make a sustainable business a lot more than that. And so while the geeks and the people thinking about these sort of things may make up 10, 20, 25% of the market, Microsoft cannot be successful with them alone. It needs the others, and creating a rounded product for them, for their needs, is probably the priority. Doesn't mean I wouldn't like to see things like some micro SD card support, or I wouldn't like to see some bit better legacy support in there. But I think you have to, again, you know, it's a question of resources. You have to focus on one thing. Otherwise, you risk being distracted by the others. And so I'm actually quite optimistic about what Microsoft can do here. So it depends on execution. It's a lot of it down to marketing. But I think if Apple can do it, I think Microsoft can do so as well. And they demonstrated that fairly effectively, I think, with the Xbox 360. They didn't necessarily get it right the first time with Xbox, but now it's become established and respected as a player in the console market. And I think it's just as equally likely to happen that they could do a similar thing in the mobile market, with kind of the Apple, Microsoft, and maybe the high-end Android devices being those tablet-esque devices. Now, of course, that doesn't really address the whole mobile market. And as I say, it's vertical, no longer a horizontal player, which really suggests to me it's a duke out between Android and Symbian in that kind of horizontal space in the market, as has been suggested both by Symbian themselves and plenty of Nokia executives too. So interesting space to watch for sure.
But the problem is with these things will appear to appeal to general consumers and not necessarily to the geeks, is that the geeks and the high-end people, they're the people who write the reviews, and they're the people who write the blog articles and the features, and they're the people who make all the noise. So it's a very tricky balance that I think Microsoft are taking a huge risk in going down this route, doing a complete binary compatibility break. Now, Symbian had a break in compatibility forced on it with platform security and Symbian OS 9 about 3 years ago. In some senses, it took quite a while to get over. And there's going to be another one coming up in 2 or 3 years' time. But even throughout that, Symbian did try and keep parts of the interface as similar as possible, so that at least you could move up your experience from a 60-second edition device to a third edition device. And there wasn't that much of a difference to the user interface. What Microsoft are doing, and not only saying there's no binary compatibility, but we're going to change everything else about it too, which I just think is maybe one step too far.
I think you can certainly have a debate about this, but I think the risk that they're taking has commensurate rewards, really. And I think, as you say, we're going to see the same thing with Symbian 3, Symbian 4. It'll be slightly less radical there, but you could make a comparison between Nokia switching from Symbian to MeeGo for sort of its mobile computing devices. And I think Microsoft is really looking at that really high-end thing. We may see them introduce new things again at sort of the low or the mid-tier low end. What they're doing initially, at least, is having Windows Mobile 6.5 as kind of phone starter edition, I believe it's being branded. I won't comment on the branding. I'm not sure that's a particular strength of Microsoft. But so those devices will still be around for those who want them. I think the main attention will go on to Windows Phone 7 series for obvious reasons. So there is, it's not sort of disappearing altogether. Yes, it's an interesting debate, and I think would love to hear from people on their views on this as well, because it's one that I'm sort of still thinking about, and a lot of it is sort of wait and see. But I think there's an automatic tendency to be a bit sceptical about Microsoft, as there has been about Nokia and Symbian in sort of the wider sort of blogosphere and tech media. And I'm just perhaps maybe just sort of thinking, I've seen the same thing happen to Nokia and Symbian, and you suggested there that the early adopters and the power users are the ones who write the reviews. That's absolutely right, and they've been castigating Nokia and Symbian for the last 2 years, and it hasn't really affected Symbian's market share in the way you might expect. Yes, there's been a decrease, but I think that's reflecting increasing competition overall. If you read any of these reviews or these analysts, many of whom are perhaps best armchair analysts, they have been suggesting that Nokia and Symbian would become irrelevant, and clearly that's not the case, as we've talked about very often on this podcast. So trying to juggle in your mind where each platform is going and the implications on the market is a tricky thing indeed. And I think having seen some of the negative press around Windows Phone 7 series, I think everyone's agreed it's a visual departure, and that's a good thing. I have quite a lot of confidence that Microsoft will be able to pull something off. To the same extent of Apple coming into the market with iPhone, no, I don't think so. But Microsoft do have a tendency to do things on the long burn. And again, I'll sort of draw attention to something like the Xbox. And I think you can actually see the Zune devices as something of a precursor to Windows Phone 7 series. Very similar UI. Yeah. And if you use a Zune device, it's a pretty compelling experience. You know, they do have a very nice user interface. There it's so far behind, partly because of the power of the iPod brand, so it was never able to get in there. And I think a similar thing happened with the Xbox, and it'd be interesting. I suspect Microsoft are going to throw an awful lot of money at Windows Phone 7 series, both in terms of marketing and getting it right, because they realize as much as anyone else how important this mobile digital space is, because these are the devices that will become your default entry point to the digital world.
Yeah. So all about WindowsPhone7Series.com?
I think we've got enough on our plates with Symbian right now, and indeed MeeGo going forward in the next couple of years. But I'd like to use all the different platforms so we can give you an informed opinion. I know Steve's been using the Android device recently. I've been trying out one of the low-end Android devices, the T-Mobile Pulse, which certainly has its benefits. I think we'll be seeing Android in the sort of mid-tier and the low-end a lot more overall, but I will certainly be looking forward to getting my hands on a Windows Phone 7 series, if only to compare it to what's coming from HTC, what's coming from Motorola, from Samsung, from Nokia, from Sony Ericsson. You know, variety is the spice of life.
Yeah, and we can only really say something in the Symbian world is good or bad in comparison to what else is out there, that these things aren't standalone, they're not islands, as it were.
Yeah, no, you need to have a truly objective opinion. You really need to be looking at everything, and we do our best to do that.
Yeah. If you want to find out more of my dealings with Android, by the way, people can also find me over on 3lib.ukonline.co.uk, where you can find my phone show, where I play with all these weird non-Symbian gadgets and give my opinion. So you can check me out there.
And also, check out Steve's phone chat show, which he does every week with Tim Salmon, and sort of does generic coverage of mobile as well. And that's always good if you need an hour's podcast to sort of fill a commute or something like that. I can thoroughly recommend it.
Oh yeah, from the mouth of the Blandford there, a recommendation, that's good. You can find out more about Rafe and his inner thoughts at the AAS and the Rafe Blandford Twitter accounts. I'm Steve Litchfield on Twitter. We also have Ewan on Twitter, and he'll be, I'm sure he's posting from America, and he'll be back with us next week. But for now, I think we're out of time, so we'll see you all then.
And goodbye from me as well. See you next week.